Hello, good afternoon. Sláinte, and welcome to Open Sources Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM. My name is Scotty Hertz, joining you once again from the bleak little bunker that I broadcast from every Thursday at this time. It is 5 p.m.-ish. Today in the program, we will be discussing a few things, but first, let me make sure that Adam A. Donaldson is on the line. Adam, are you there?
Yes.
Oh, he is. Oh, good. Excellent. So you never know these days where anybody's going to be. You just don't. You have no idea. They got a mask on. You can't tell. But I see you're there. That's fantastic. Today in the program, we'll be talking about a wildcat strike in Alberta that took place this week due to cuts that are probably coming to healthcare in that province. Caledonia, to the south of us, on Highway 6, Lambeck Lane, is in a blockade situation, and that has heated up quite a bit, actually, in the past few days, and we'll get the latest on that, discuss that a bit. Elections galore in the whole country this week from a couple of provinces and by-elections in Toronto. But first, Adam, of course, what is on everybody's mind and everybody's lips and all day, all night, 24/7, is the U.S. election. Just can't get enough, as Depeche Mode said. It just keeps on giving. I've been all over the place today, Adam. So is there any sort of late breaking news today in terms of what's going on? I've heard lots of little anecdotal things. For example, the number of advanced ballots that are in kept changing daily by millions. At the beginning of the week, it was 60 million people had voted in advance. The last number I heard was 75 million people have voted in advance for the presidential election in the States, which has to be unprecedented. I've never heard a number that high.
It is up to 79 now.
Wow. So it's even like 4 million since I wrote that down yesterday. Yeah,
it's pretty impressive. I think the number in Texas is something like 8.6 million ballots, and the number of total ballots cast in 2016 was like 8.9.
Wow.
So that's, you know, I guess if everyone who voted in Texas in 2016 is voting in advance this year, I mean, it'll be interesting to see what exactly it looks like on election day, just how many more ballots there are out there left to come in before election day, and then on election day, how many people have decided to leave it to the exact last minute. And maybe the polls won't be as busy on election day, and which, you know, could be a good thing in some places where they've struggled to staff up polling places, or places, frankly, where Republicans have sabotaged the effort to have a number of polling places. It's one of the little question marks that has us on the edge of our seats.
And there seem to be quite a few people lined up in advance, lots of shots of people in lines in various states trying to vote in person and waiting for hours and hours, and in some cases in all kinds of weather. I did see one, there was a Supreme Court decision talking about Wisconsin and ballots being stamped on election day and what is going to count.
Yes.
Weirdly, and I don't think, maybe a lot of people don't realize this, that in the U.S., even though it's for, you know, the president is a federal position, the states all run their elections in their own way. And anybody that remembers the 2000 election with the dangling chads, voting techniques can be different. I think there is some sort of standardization of mail-in ballots. And I watched, I think it was in the New York Times, a breakdown of everything that goes into counting a mail-in ballot. And it's almost ridiculous the amount of work involved just to get one single vote. And then if a ballot is damaged, they can be sent to scrutineers who will decide as to whether that, you know, it's valid or not, or who did they vote for, a bipartisan thing. It's very heavy on the complication, let's say, and the potential to go wrong. But one thing I can say, here's my prediction for election night, and hopefully we're going to have some coverage. We need to discuss that, actually, Adam, but we're hoping to have a show here of some description on Tuesday, all things considered, because we normally kick out the stops as we did 4 years ago. But here's my prediction, and I'm going to give it now, that if Trump is ahead even by a little bit on Election Day, on next Tuesday, he's probably going to kick and scream when it becomes clear that Biden might be coming up the rear with votes, either mail-in or what have you. And I think that is where the trouble is going to begin. I think everybody is anticipating a problem on Election Day of some kind, whether it's a legitimate problem in terms of ballots or something falling apart in certain places or finding them in the river or whatever the heck Trump is saying today as to what's going to happen to ballots. But also, if it does appear, just even the numbers on Fox, if Fox says Trump is ahead, he will decide in his head that he is ahead. And of course, the whole fraudulent and everything that he's been harping on about, whether it's fraudulent or not, doesn't matter. Whatever Trump says is what it's going to be really interesting as to what his behavior is on election night, I think.
Yes, and that's kind of where that Wisconsin decision you talked about comes into play, because what it did is say that any ballots that come in after Election Day, even if they are postmarked for Election Day, and that's supposed to be the sort of deadline, is that if they are stamped with at a postal machine for Election Day, which is November 3rd, then they are still counted, even if they come in on Wednesday or Thursday. And that Supreme Court decision said, no, only ballots that come in on Election Day or before will be counted. Now, why does that matter? Well, because there are so many mail-in ballots coming in, and this play, and it's right there in Brett Kavanaugh's decision, and you know it's terribly telling that it's Brett Kavanaugh writing this decision, that he basically adds legitimacy to this conspiracy theory on the part of Trump that if it comes in after the Election Day, you get these absentee ballots, and they happen to push Joe Biden over the top in some place like Michigan or Pennsylvania or Florida, where it's presumed the number of votes will be close, then it is because the deep state or whatever saw that Joe Biden was going to lose this state, so they took all these pre-made ballots out of their mysterious sack and shoved them in with the mail so that Joe Biden would quote-unquote falsely win the election, which is all utter and complete nonsense, because that's proven time and time and again, including by Donald Trump's own task force on the matter. Election fraud is so exceedingly low, it might as well not exist at all.
And of course, as we know, any problems in this will eventually go to the Supreme Court, which may speak to the kind of ramming through of the Amy Coney Barrett nomination to have a full slate on the Supreme Court when something as heavy as this might be coming down the pipe, votes being contested in various places. You know, this, I think there's a lot to that in terms of where a decision, if it does go to the Supreme Court, might go. By the sounds of it, if polls are anything to go by in general, whatever, even you know the reactions from a lot of Republicans, Trump is this is a terrible metaphor. I was going to say swirling the bowl, but yeah, that, I mean, it's, it was the first thing that popped into my head. It's like, where do you see Trump in a week? It's like, you know, it doesn't seem to be numerically looking good for him. He's been doing the tours of the swing states this week, and you know, you can tell a lot by how a candidate and their team think it's going, by the places that they go in the final hours of any campaign.
Right.
And Trump has been going to these places, including what sounds like the worst rally ever, where people were stranded and getting hypothermia in the dark. But damn it, they saw their man, and yeah, it was well worth it. I mean, somebody probably could have died in that the Nebraska situation there. But
well, somebody still might die in the coming weeks from COVID-19.
Oh, and that too, of course. Yeah, shouldn't laugh, but yeah, that's you know, talk about
Nebraska case that you mentioned there is interesting, because it has to do with the fact Nebraska is one of these few states that will split the Electoral College votes. And I've seen a couple of people explain this. The reason why he went to Nebraska,
of all places, yeah.
Which is a state he's going to win like 4 out of the 5 Electoral College votes for. The reason he went to Nebraska is to see if he could get that fifth one, because there's this mathematical probability that Trump and Biden could split the votes in such a way mm-hmm. that that one Nebraska electoral college seat would give Joe Biden 270 and Donald Trump 268, and you need 270 to win. So theoretically, if Trump were to steal that one Nebraska electoral college vote, they would both be tied 269 to 269, and then that becomes a legal mess.
Supreme Court territory, yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's the extraordinary unlikelihood that this is going to end in a statistical tie. But I mean, when you're down this far, like Donald Trump, you pretty much have to try everything, including the Hail Mary, and almost literally, you know, using that term correctly, even mm-hmm. though it's not a football play. But I mean, that is literally a Hail Mary play, electorally speaking.
Yeah. Hail somebody for sure. We don't know. We don't know who. Yeah, so much has happened. Did you see anything about Miles Taylor, the sort of deep throat leaker, liar and coward, as he's being called by McEnany, about who he'd written that op-ed and the book? What was the book called again? A Warning.
A warning.
It was called right.
A Warning.
Yes, and it looks like his identity has been revealed, and he is. Claims to still be a Republican, but of course, all things considered, is coming out against Trump.
I mean, I think that's almost kind of come and gone. I've been watching the U.S. cable news pretty much all day, and nobody's really talked about it too much. It's just the fire hose has been open all week in terms of breaking news, and I mean, not the least of it too is the COVID. There are no states right now in which COVID numbers are going down. Mm. They are all going up, except for in two or three select places where they are holding steady. You know, they have Utah, where they're more or less starting to do triage on COVID patients, like finding out who is so sick that they have to be treated and who is maybe not so sick that they could be moved to somewhere else to be treated. Same things happening in El Paso. You know, you have Wisconsin, which is seeing cases skyrocket again. And Mike Pence goes there to do a rally of his own.
After his whole gang had tested positive, right? Or five of his people?
Five senior staffers, yeah. Including his chief of staff, who you have to imagine is at his hip.
With no mask on. Yeah.
Well, no mask on, but the chief of staff got COVID, and so did one of the senior advisors. And he's going around the country unmasked, unwilling to stand down. I mean, it's standing in stark contrast to the woman who... looks good to succeed him as the vice president. You know, Kamala Harris had campaign staffers who caught COVID, and she was off the campaign trail for 4 or 5 days just mm-hmm. to make sure she wasn't COVID positive. So yeah, it's all kind of coming down to, I think, because Donald Trump has, you know, he keeps talking about rounding the curve. He sounds like he's trying to hypnotize people, but. You know, it's going to come down to, are people going to buy that, or are people going to be keenly aware of the changes in their own lives, having to go out in a mask, or even go, like, if they refuse to wear a mask, constantly being the town pariah and going to places where people are saying, hey, you put on a mask, and then you go on about, you know, fake news and the deep state and all that.
Then he gets socked in the jaw.
The numbers keep going in the wrong direction. You know, 230,000 dead now. Almost a quarter of a million dead.
But Adam, it's because they're doing more tests. And when you do more tests, you get more cases, right? I shouldn't laugh. 230,000 people dead is not funny at all. But it's the way that Trump goes on about it. Like, well, there's more, you know, and like he's almost, to me, personally, impossible to listen to now. Except except as, you know, the ultimate clown, the buffoon. But tell you something, though, Adam.
You can't be listened to as a clown because, like, people are dead. You have dead bodies on the deck, 230,000.
The most...
Like, you can't take him, quote-unquote, seriously as a clown anymore.
The most grim clown that has walked the earth. But I'll tell you one thing. The New Hampshire union leader endorsed Biden. It's the first time they've endorsed a non-Republican in 100 years. So it's all over for Trump, right?
Everybody's freaking endorsing Biden. The question is, will it matter? And I think...
No, I'm just... I was trying to be facetious there. But yeah, it's like, okay, you know, New Hampshire paper, that I don't know who's reading it.
Who is endorsing Donald Trump? Mad Magazine? I don't think they're in business anymore. It's
Mad Magazine.
It's that bad. And I think, I mean, we'll see on election day. Just a lot of people are unsure. You know, the sign that there are a lot of people out early voting could mean something bad for Donald Trump. True. But to throw a bit of cold water on that, I will say that, you know, Beto O'Rourke hit all his targets in terms of get out the vote efforts in 2018, and he still lost that Senate seat by 2 or 3 points. Mm-hmm. And that is because Republican get out the vote efforts were more successful in terms of increasing the number of Republicans who got out to vote in 2018. And that was for Ted Cruz, who nobody likes. We're going to be on the edge of our seats until somebody actually calls this thing on Tuesday or Wednesday, or even, you know, maybe even not this time next week.
Yeah.
So
we'll see.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of being called, 4 elections in Canada this week, 2 provincial, in one in BC and one in Saskatchewan, and also 2 federal by-elections in Toronto. Toronto Centre and York Centre? Is that right? I've got the ridings all wrong. Yes. For 10 points, name the ridings where the by-elections were that hardly anybody went to. Well, I mean, a few people went. I think that it sounded like the turnouts for the by-elections in Toronto were higher than normal by-election. Sometimes it's like 10%, and I think these ones were in the 30s, maybe, or close to the 30% range, so that's fairly high.
Toronto Centre was... No, I have it.
I knew you'd have the number, right?
Toronto Centre was 30, almost 31%, and York Centre was just under 26%.
So as far as a by-election goes, that is fairly high. Liberals holding both seats with Marcy Ian and Toronto Centre. And tell me the other winner's name again. It's
like... Her name
I cannot read my own writing.
Yara Sachs.
And both rookies, right? Neither one have ever really, that we know of, had any liberal involvement or?
Oh, well, I'm not sure I'd call Marcy Ian a rookie. She was like on Canada AM forever. But
oh, no. I mean a rookie in terms of politics.
Yes, they're both
rookie. We know who she is. And I think Yara is also.
Yara
is fairly well known in the area, as well as I believe she's some kind of activist.
Yes, she's an activist. I mean, she's long been kind of like a anti-Netanyahu, pro-Israel activist. She's like a health
advocate,
a health professional in the Toronto area. Yeah,
it was good to see that a lot of the perennials, like John the Engineer Trammell and Kevin Clark, and of course somebody who's been on our show above Zanunavda, all made it out as well. So
yeah.
You know, here's to the fringe and their 100 votes each. But also on the fringe, and still on the fringe, why he even bothered, I don't know. Max Bernier of the People's Party decided to try his hand at York Centre. Who knows why? Only Max Bernier knows why. Top of the fringe vote, I guess, somewhere in the 600s, right? But, you know, at this point, it's like, who cares, Max? Like, just...
3.6%.
Woo! 3.6%. Yeehaw.
At the same time, more than the Green Party candidate in York Centre, but by a full percentage point.
And that's interesting, isn't it? You've got the Green Party in the one riding at 3%, and then you've got Anime Paul in the other riding, head-to-head with Marcy in second place. It was 33%, I think, right? Does that sound right?
32.7. So rounded up the 33. It wasn't an easy run for either of the Liberal candidates. Brian Chang came in third place in Toronto Centre. He ran last time for the NDP and seems to sort of be well liked enough. But and then, you know, a 9-point difference between Marcy Ian and Annamie Paul, who is granted the Green Party leader, but this is like a super, super safe Liberal riding. Mm-hmm. Bill Morneau won twice with 57%. In York Centre, Yahara Sachs won with 45.7%, while Julius Sangson won 41.8%. So it was like a little less than 4%. And of course, I mean, that New York Central was a Tory riding in 2011 and in the last two elections before the liberal sweep in 2015, that was a fairly, not a strong Tory riding, but, you know, strong enough that they were able to win it twice. So it was a little bit tighter there. So someone with some degree of concern for electoral prospects in a liberal party might read that as maybe we should clean up our act a little bit. Mm-hmm. But I doubt it, because they're going to take both the wins and keep on keeping on.
Yeah, and there's always a little bit of divining goes on with by-elections in terms of the most I was going to say not unlikely result, but if the Liberals had lost, that's when, you know, a by-election carries huge weight and huge significance. Whereas in this case, it's just sort of like, even though the numbers are lower, clearer across the board, both in turnout and the votes received, when it's status quo, it's kind of seen as a bit of a thumbs up to the existing government, right? But
I would almost argue, and I mean, we always kind of miss the point with these things, that, you know, by-elections can always be more meaningful, because 30%, you know, 30-35%, that's considered a good by-election. Mm-hmm. Just like 10 more percent, like if 10 more percent showed up and they all voted for Annamie Paul, she would be the fourth green MP in the House of Commons right now. So and this just came to me too, and nothing to do with sort of my prep for the show today, but just, we kind of underestimate the value of by-elections, especially open. I mean, all by-elections are open. There's never an incumbent running in the by-election, but mm-hmm. I mean, because it's an open contest, because there's no national contest going on that could sort of split the area's attention. Like, there's no prime minister, you know, debate or anything like that. These could be much bigger deals in these areas where we have the by-elections, but that never seems to be the case, and that's my two cents.
And speaking of turnouts high and low, it was an all-time low turnout for the BC election. 52.4% cast a ballot. Now, of course, as we know, in pandemic times, that number is probably a reflection of the times, but the John Horgan NDP re-elected bit of a trounce, actually. What was it? 55 of 87 seats for the NDP, Liberals at 29, and the Greens stalled at 3 in the same configuration that they were before the election. So, but it, you know, with the popularity numbers that Horgan had, and it's not really a surprise that the result was that high. And Andrew Wilkinson of the Liberals stepping down. So that was a fairly short 10 years of leadership of the Liberals, I think. He wasn't in very long. Well, I didn't even actually recognize him when he was doing the rounds in the media. I was like, oh, yeah, that's the Liberal guy. And, of course, this has prompted some talk as to whether the Liberals and the Conservatives should actually merge and run at it that way. Because there was a lot of seats where the Conservative vote went up, which made the Liberals, people should know that the Liberal Party in BC pretty much runs as a Conservative outfit, or Conservative minded, more Conservative than Liberals elsewhere. So it can be a bit confusing. I mean, technically they're Liberals, but realistically they're not. So
I didn't crunch the numbers, but I know that the Conservatives in BC ran in 19 places, and considering that, number one, the NDP picked up seats almost entirely from Liberal ridings, and number two, that was a difference of like maybe 12 seats. Those 19 Conservative candidates must have been like super strategic, if we're kind of like putting some blame on them. Mm-hmm. That it was in sort of those places, because there was, I guess, vote splitting between the Liberals and the Conservatives that allowed the NDP to sneak up the middle. I mean, that must be like an electoral map miracle for the NDP. So that may be, I don't know, I would have to sort of analyze the numbers a bit, and I'm probably not going to do that because I have a lot of my own work to do, but I mean, that just seems
unlikely. Let somebody else do it, yeah.
Yeah, let somebody in BC do it. But the thing about that struck me too is I understand why Wilkinson is out. I mean, when you sort of lose that badly, I guess good conduct demands you get out of the way. But on the other hand, snap election, pandemic election, outstanding, favorability for the incumbent. I mean, that was an uphill slog. And I mean, and the Liberals almost damning themselves now too, because unless there's like a serious screw up on the part of Horgan and the NDP, either with the pandemic response or on another issue like pipelines or something, they're starting off this next election cycle on the back foot by having to start again from scratch by getting a new leader, rather than letting Wilkinson take any lessons he might have learned from this race and allowing him to sort of help rebuild up, having been in the trenches and knowing where he screwed up. It just seems like maybe, and not to tell the BC Liberals what to do, but it maybe seems a bit like they're cutting off their nose to spite their face by having him shoved out the door so fast.
And the final numbers won't be in until November 16th, so there's a long lag time in terms of counting up all the ballots that came in via mail. It sounds like there was quite a few. Turning to Saskatchewan, and not really a surprise there, the historic win for the Saskatchewan Party, their fourth term. I haven't seen the likes of that since the NDP / I guess CCF stretch from 1944, when they were untouchable pretty much in that province. So things have definitely flipped in Saskatchewan. It sounds like 70% of the vote outside of the major centers, Saskatoon, and Regina, went to the Saskatchewan Party. So that's untouchable. It's unbeatable when you're getting numbers like that. And same for the second place leader there, in this case, the NDP. So talk about, two provinces over and the tables turn. Ryan Miele could be the third NDP leader in a row that's, destroyed, I guess, in an election from the Saskatchewan Party. And they had, I believe it was 14 times as many mail-in ballots from the previous election, something like 61,000 plus.
Yeah.
So that is, I guess, yet to be counted as well. And interestingly, in terms of the fringe, the Buffalo Party, subject to some mockery on the show by me, on the rise. Third, what did they get? Third in the popular vote? And they got more votes than the Green Party with one third of the candidates. So this is similar to that, the conservative scenario you were talking about in BC there. I was surprised at that. I was like, boy, they, it sounds like Scott Moe recognized this and made not quite a shout out, but he said, we're unhappy with Ottawa as well. So that's sort of his backhanded way of doing a shout out to the Buffalo Party, saying, yeah, we hear you. But we'll see where that goes.
The only thing I have to say about Saskatchewan, too, is like here again, like they're touting the voter turnout, which was 53%, which means, 47% of the available electors in Saskatchewan sat home or didn't fill in a mail-in ballot or whatever. And it just seems like there's some untapped political, I don't know, when you have 50, even when, you're in the middle of a pandemic, you expect the voter turnout to go down. It went up to 53%. But I mean, when it's that low, in non-pandemic times, you are not reaching half your the potential electors. I mean, there's something kind of weird about that. At least in terms of looking at provincial politics across the country, 50 is really, really low. I mean, when your best is like 53%, I don't know. There's something to that there. And again, I'll leave it to somebody in Saskatchewan to try and figure that out. But I will make the point that, yeah, there seems to be a lot of room to grow for political politics in Saskatchewan.
And we'll see how many more pandemic, I guess there will be, whether we like it or not, a few more pandemic elections. And of course, we will cover them here on Open Sources Guelph on CFRU 93.3 FM. We're going to take a little bit of a breather for some announcements, a little bit of music, and then we'll be back in short order. So please stay tuned. A voice was sounding,
This land was made for you and me. When the sun comes shining, then I was strolling, and the wheat fields waving, and the dust clouds rolling. The voice was chanting as the fog was lifting. This land was made for you and me. This land is your land, and this land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me.
All right, there you have it. A song that was written, I believe, in response to God Bless America. That was This Land Is Your Land, unmistakable by Woody Guthrie, covered by many, many people from right across the spectrum, and is in some ways an unofficial anthem of the U.S. of A. So that's one for our American friends. So, Adam, to the south of us now in Caledonia on Highway 6. This is a land dispute that has flared up many, many times over the past, well, I was going to say recent years, but it's a longer run than that. The Haldimand Tract and the Haldimand Proclamation. There's a video released on the weekend of a couple of youths beating on a police car, and there's some question as to whether that video occurred before or after the police action, which in turn inflamed the situation down there. It sounds like rubber bullets were involved, and somebody was tasered. It's possible that the assault on the police car, which is considered, quote, violence, was before or after that incident. It's uncertain. There's the information is there's two versions of the story coming out there. But, you know, what has been happening is that nothing has been happening. The blockade has occurred. There's been no discussions in terms of what the community would like to have with the feds and, I believe, the province. So there's this simmering standoff, which I think is on day 100, give or take, now at this point.
It was day 100 on Monday.
Actually. Oh, there you go. Yep. So 100 plus, still no movement.
Yeah, and that whole video, which was a minute long, taken from inside the police cruiser, one person had a lacrosse stick. The person was throwing, it seemed like rocks or whatever was kind of on the ground. There was kind of no context for it. And then on top of it all, it was tweeted by the OPP commissioner himself.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I saw like a laundered version of like four or five people down the line, but I didn't realize that.
Right. And it's just, you know,
inflaming.
It's like
the situation.
Everybody wants to cool this down, right? And yeah, it looks bad. Like the video taken on its own, whatever context it came out of, but just that minute long video looks bad. These people look angry. It looks like something out of a horror movie or like The Warriors or something.
Yeah.
Unless you know what happened. And then you had Skylar Williams, who's sort of been the spokesperson, the ambassador for the protesters, is like, well, hold on, there was stuff going on down the road at this legal camp, this kind of staging area they have, that, you know, wasn't on video. The police were being very showing, I don't know, making some sort of show of strength. So, you know, we have no idea. But the fact that it was just the OPP commissioner, like, look at these scary effing Indians.
Well, that
coming
is...
coming after this cop who's just sitting there doing his... And look how he's not reacting. Look how he's sitting there and recording it and not taking any action. We're the good guys. They're the bad guys. This is how we're framing it.
Thin blue line. Yeah, context is everything, right? So there's obviously way more to that video. Perhaps there's part of that video that shows people getting rubber bullets and tased, but it's not it's not clear, but what is clear, as you say, there's a certain message trying to be sent there. And the message from the Land Back Lane protesters is, would somebody from the feds, whose responsibility this is, please come and talk to us? And it sounds like that's the number one thing that they've been asking for, because this, you know, the land dispute ongoing. I don't know if you've seen that graphic that's making the rounds in terms of what the original Haldeman Tract was. There's a long history to it, but the dispute began almost right away in terms of where it ended. Does it end in Elora? Was there clear title on it from the, I believe it was bought from the Mississaugas, right? So there's confusion as to that. There's ancient paperwork regarding it, but what has been clear over the years is that what was, you know, assumed to be indigenous land has been at, I guess, a 95% loss since that was originally laid out. And some confusion as to whether it was surrendered or not. When the Crown sold it, there was, I guess there had been squatters on it. So it's a process that's been going on for years and years and years. And it doesn't seem like there's any movement to sort the thing out. Now they're at the point where, you know, this subdivision supposedly is going in. There's been, I guess, a couple of injunctions saying you have to clear away, get your stuff and get out. And, you know, which has led to the standoff now, but there's been no, I believe that Skylar Walker or Williams in court had said, look, you know, all we want is somebody to come and talk to us. And I was like, no, just get your stuff, get out, just thrown out. So, it's
right. And the mayor,
where
the mayor down there hasn't helped either.
Oh no, the mayor. Yeah, the mayor is. What did he call the? I guess St. Catharines City Council passed a motion in solidarity, and the mayor is like, "Oh, they've got a leftist agenda." I mean, he sounds like the typical, like, just. But then, of course, on the other side, we have MPP Matthew Green donating money, which, of course, I'm sure Mayor Ken Hewitt of Haldeman doesn't like that too much anymore. I believe the number was 1492. So, you know, talk about making a statement, not backhanded at all. So there's, you know, the lines are drawn and the sides are, not clear, but you can, you know, it's not hard to tell which side anyone is on when they speak both to the media, when you hear stories like that, right? So,
well, the trouble is, this is like, there's one party that is missing from all this, and it is the essential party, and that is the federal government. Mm-hmm. This is a deal that goes back between the Crown and the indigenous people who were on that land, who represents the Crown in this case. Well, I mean, technically the Governor General, but since, you know, we are our own country with our own laws and things, it should be the federal government. And Skylar Williams is like, yeah, I talked Mark Miller on the phone once. It's like, once? Really? That's it? And are we supposed to believe that maybe all of Mark Miller's time is being taken up by, you know, the First Nations Reserve that had to basically abandon ship because their water was so toxic? Mm-hmm. That's all really hard to believe. And, it, you know, I don't pay attention to every press conference that Justin Trudeau does, but at the same time, I have not heard anyone asking him about it in a press conference. I have not heard him talk about it in a press conference. Right.
But Miller managed to make it to the rail blockade when that was happening down in near Kingston, mm-hmm. right?
Right. But that's also, I mean, context. Speaking of context, when it's kind of like a positive story in which the Liberals don't take any blame or have to shoulder any responsibility in finding a solution, they're there. If the Assembly of First Nations wants to give Justin Trudeau a pat on the back for being a good boy, for recognizing that there is a need for reconciliation, Justin Trudeau will be there to get that honor. But where is the federal government when this is their jurisdiction? The protesters, the land defenders there want to deal with the feds. And I mean, this goes to Ken Hewitt too. Why isn't he on the phone? Why isn't he on the phone to his MP? I'm not sure who his MP is, but you know,
his MP might be Matthew Green. Oh no, that's how he's Hamilton Center. So no, I'm not sure.
I mean, even at that, you know, why aren't you on, this is a federal matter. Why aren't you on the phone with your federal representative saying, hey, can you do more to lean on, the Minister of Indigenous Affairs or the Minister of Crown Indigenous Relations to get them down here so we can start beginning to sort this out instead of yelling at the Indigenous people who are just fighting for their freaking land rights. There's some person missing at the table, and you should be yelling at the person who's missing from the table instead of the other guy who's across the table from you.
Yeah, they definitely dropped the ball on this, because I haven't heard even a rumor of movement that, oh yeah, and you know, because sometimes in situations they'll be like, oh, in a few days so and so will be coming down, but I'm sure they'll just say pandemic, and you know, that's as to why no one has showed up. But they seem to be able to show up for other things, you know, of whatever significance. So if you can do that, I believe somebody could make it down.
Again, but though Justin Trudeau and other ministers are traveling across the country to have like announcements of things, and when it's a good news story, they will make the trip. When it's something that's a bit more nebulous like this, where they might take some political heat above and beyond the normal, they're reticent. And it's like, you're not there to be the Minister of Indigenous Affairs in the good times. You know, if there are good times when you're managing the Indigenous Affairs portfolio.
Yeah, and I don't know why. Are they waiting for the OPP? Because I guess it's down to the OPP at this point to supposedly, well, I hate to say take care of it, but there seems to be this waiting game going on. So I hate to predict this, but the inevitable outcome of these things in the past has been at 6 a.m. they move in, right, and they'll do the sweep
which is standard tactics.
But you know, hopefully it doesn't happen, then that they're able to have the discussions that they want. But I you know, usually there's just a bit of a waiting game, and then I guess, and the longer they wait too, the colder it gets, and so, you know, it remains to be seen where this one is going to go. But, you know, definitely the evolving story, and hopefully they come to some kind of resolution. But, you know, the solution sounds simple, so we'll see. Yeah, so there was quite a few, a solidarity march on the weekend. At one point, the OPP were arresting everybody. I believe Tom Wilson, musician, went and performed a show, and he got arrested. And also the journalist with iHeartRadio. It's got a show on 610. I've heard it. What is the one? I can't remember the exact name. He was arrested just trying to cover the story. I don't think any of the labor leaders that were there on the weekend and the others that were there were arrested. So it's hit and miss. But it sounds like they're just charging any Indigenous people that go close to the blockade. So, again, an evolving story. We'll come back to it. I'm almost certain. Also, an evolving story, the wildcat in Alberta, which only lasted a day. It's not the wildcat itself that's the story, but the fact that in the middle of everything that's going on and talking about essential workers and those that are critical during pandemic COVID-19 times, the Kenny government announced that they were going to lay off 11,000 people. Now, this didn't include doctors and nurses in the medical community, hospitals and whatnot, but clerical staff, porters, cleaners, food service. So they decided to step out. Very, very classic labor move they don't see too often these days. It's like, well, if you're going to lay us all off, we're just going to show our displeasure by walking out. And of course, that sets up the whole, well, you walked out, and you're letting people down. It sounds like some procedures and that were canceled, but according to the other associations, including the ones that covered doctors and nurses, they said at no time was anybody's safety directly at risk due to this walkout. So an interesting approach to take. I don't think the union itself, ALPI, do they call themselves ALPI?
I don't think so.
The QP equivalent of in Alberta, the Alberta Union of Public Employees, didn't officially advocate for their people to walk out, but their people did walk out. So, of course, once they did, they supported them because labor leaders have ended up in jail over things like this, illegal walkouts. So you need to walk a bit of a fine line when the workers take things into their own hands.
Yeah, and to be clear, the move we're talking about is that Tyler Chandro,
yes, I think so. Sandra with an H. Chandro. Oh,
it's almost like Sharknado, but it's Shandro. Because it's fine, because he's...
That would make him way cooler than he actually is, right?
Well, I mean, he's...
Tyler Sharknado.
He's been kicking up a Sharknado of news for covering the health beat in Alberta. But, I mean, this was an announcement a couple of weeks ago that they're going to cut 9,700 to 11,000 jobs at Alberta hospitals. This is not doctors or nurses, but it's, I mean, they couched it with, we're not cutting any frontline medical personnel, which is how you kind of phrase these things. But we're talking about laboratory workers, people who work in like the cafeterias and do inpatient care, like delivering meals to patients' rooms, and people who do the laundry. So, you know, like these sorts of jobs, these like supportive jobs in the hospital. And they're going to be, you know, outsourcing, basically having private contractors take it over. So Shandro sold it as like, well, in the end, nobody's really going to be losing their jobs. And it's like, well, fair enough. But are they going to get paid a lot less for doing the same job? Absolutely. So, I mean, it's a canary in the coal mine thing, too, for a lot of people who work in hospitals, because, I mean, those are always the first people to go, is these people you can outsource, mm-hmm. You know, the support staff. And nurses are looking at this going, okay, so now you're going after these employees, kind of like on the low end of the food chain here at the hospital. Who comes after that?
Right.
The nurses. And so now the nurses are sweating, and the nurses don't need an extra reason to sweat because, you know, they're on, you know, the second or third wave, depending on where they are, probably just second wave. But, you know, they're working all out 24 hours a day, 7 days a week to keep the pandemic under control. And now they have to worry about job security. Come on. That's why there was so much, I mean, even just tacit quiet support for this wildcat lockout. I mean, yeah, the union leaders can't say that, you know, yeah, we're behind you 100% to do this illegal strike action. But I think anyone in the health profession in Alberta was sort of feeling it on Monday.
Yeah, and the union, oh boy, the United Conservative Party, not a union, have a pathological hate on for unions. Yeah. Love the free market, and they want to privatize everything. They've been fairly clear about that. There's no hiding it. I mean, these are the conservatives on steroids, right? So we just privatize everything. There's no secret there. But what's interesting is the change in the language, because, of course, when COVID first hit and all through the summer, everybody's essential, right? All the cleaners are essential. All these other people that you've listed, everything from the linen people and lab services, super important right now. Well, you're all essential. Essential, and we love you, and we're going to clap and smash pots and pans together to give you support, not just the nurses and doctors, but everybody involved in healthcare. Now, you're a frontline worker, so the language changes. The nomenclature has changed. You're no longer essential, you're frontline. So that, you know, you can erase that frontline a little bit, like you say. You're still going to need people to do these things, but can you do them cheaper? Can you do them without being unionized? Can you do them without benefits? People think that the jobs described are plum jobs, and that everybody's, you know, there's plumbers on the sunshine list. That's not the case at all. The people that do these jobs have historically been underpaid and under, you know, represented in the scheme of things in terms of, you know, keeping it going. Let's say a lot of them live, believe it or not, a lot of people in these jobs live close to the poverty line. I know that's hard to believe because the you know, the language is always like, well, you know, yeah, union people are spoiled and this and that, but it's nothing could be further from the truth, right? And like you say, this is low-hanging fruit. Start with them, and then it's the nurse. Well, we need less nurses so they, you know, they can go too. And all of this in the middle of the largest health crisis the nation has seen, probably in 100 years, if ever, right? So modern era, right? So they're using this to their advantage to say, okay, well, we're just going to do this because, you know, this is the way it should be. And you know, when philosophical backwardness triumphs over logic, regardless of how you feel about unions, this isn't making any, you know, It defies logic that they would do this right now, but it also makes complete sense as to why they would do it right now. Just take advantage of everything that's going on and just slash and burn, right?
Well, I mean, we didn't talk about it today, but, you know, it's the same reason why the conservatives are proceeding with giving, you know, Charles McVitie and his, you know, religious institution the power to
put a whole hour on that one.
to confer, accredited degrees.
Keep the Oosterhof gang pleased, right? Yeah. No, that's true, though, right? This
friend,
is what they
your
do.
Oost got into trouble this week. Did you see?
My friend, yeah, I did see that, but I could talk about. Well, yeah, I was hoping that was on the short list of topics, but we don't really need to talk about it. But where the parallel there is not as much Oosterhof, but keeping the friends happy. Right, Ford has done this with McVitie and his college. You have to please them. You have to please the people that are involved in private healthcare, and we've seen it. Number one would be Mike Harris. Going back to those days, I know I always keep going back to that, but that is the prime example on the board at Chartwell, and also started that business Nurse Next Door with his wife, taking advantage. You make the cuts, and then when you're in the private sector, you slide right into the zone where you have cut. And I bet you if somebody does the digging in Alberta, this is the exact scenario we're going to see in healthcare there as well, that there are people waiting in the wings, the friends of Kenny, the friends of this government, of the UCP gang, who are going to slide in there and take over. I would guarantee that. I would put my life on that, that that's going to happen.
There's already been accusations against Shardo for, you know, having involvement in health benefit companies. So, I mean, it's there for sure. And this is almost worse than Harris in certain respects because, you know, they're kind of picking up lessons from people like Scott Walker in the United States, who is running right to work states, because that's what this comes down to. Like last year, late last year, they passed legislation that terminated the contracts with provincial doctors. They passed a bill to limit where unions could picket, and that barred unions from using their dues for political activities, which could, by the way, could just describe just about any union activity. And it's just been one thing after another. And I did notice this the other night on the news. Cenovus and Husky, which are two big oil companies in Alberta, announced that they were merging. And what's the first thing that comes out of the announcement of that merger? We're cutting 25% of the workforce. Mm-hmm. So
I thought you were going to say, it's Justin Trudeau's fault. No, because that's usually like the second thing that comes out, right?
Well, it's certainly not Justin's fault that they were probably merging, but it probably is Jason Kenney's fault that they're merging, because, you know, giving considerable tax cuts to big oil companies in Alberta is also part of this playbook. And I mean, and nowhere between shall meet. While Kenny is crying poverty about, you know, the increased spending on healthcare and having to cut or quote unquote find efficiencies, if you will,
equals cut. Yeah.
His tax cuts are allowing, you know, of these oil companies are allowing them to make huge profits and then merge and then cut jobs because, you know, you don't have two people doing the same job when two companies merge and become one company. That's, you know, counterintuitive from a business point of view. But it's just this. It's, you know, they're doing what they've kind of always done, but it's worse now because there's a public health crisis, and they're trying to put the challenges on the backs of the people who work in the health sector, who already have considerable challenges on their back. It's just a bad look overall, and a lot of people in Alberta hate it. And, you know, there are a lot of people who have said, you know, if this happens, I'm as a lab tech, if this happens and I am forced to either leave the province to get a comparable job for a comparable salary, or stay in this job and then work it for a private company that is paying me like half of what I was paying, or however much. Guess what I'm going to do? And it's already fostering this brain drain of medical talent, let's say, from the province, who are already, you know, fed up over these things like the termination of the contract with doctors and things like moving. This was an announcement earlier this month too, of, you know, terminating what doctors could charge in terms of overhead, where if they were in a, you know, they have a clinic and they're called to the hospital to meet with a patient, that would, they would need to get additional charges covered. And Chandro said, no, you can't do that anymore. And the doctors were like, okay, fine, we're going to be closing up our shop and leaving Alberta. And, you know, it was a threat that made Chandro back down. But at the same time, you know, they keep shooting themselves in the foot and thinking that the doctor is going to heal them.
The controversy behind Chandra just quickly was that he went to a doctor's house and confronted this doctor about something that the guy had said on social media of some kind. I think it might have been Facebook, something that was critical of the government. So we know where that guy's coming from.
Yeah, I'll tell you where, on social media.
On social media, yeah, exactly. So very, very thin skin by the sounds of it. But we do not have thin skins. We have thick skins, and we will be back next Thursday at this time. This is Open Source as Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM. And just a bit of a heads up, we may have a show on Tuesday. We're just sort of working out the finer points of that. But the Tuesday night election spectacular may happen in some form, if not remotely. Just think of it as watching the results with your friends. You can have a drink. You can do whatever you would do whilst listening to us, but we're going to sort that out. But before we sort that out, Adam, where can the people find out about you and what you do in this town?
I'm on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donson, or you can go to GuelphPolitico.ca.
I'm Scotty Hertz on Facebook, Scotty Hertz on Twitter, and as I said, you can find us here every Thursday from 5 to 6 here on Open Sources Guelph at CFRU, and you can also find us on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify, correct?
Nailed it.
Oh, finally, after 19 tries. Anyway, thank you for joining us, and we will be back, as I said, next week and possibly on Tuesdays. So we'll give you a heads up on the socials as to what's going on there. But until then, take care and have a good week.